Welcome back, everyone. What I'd like to do today, and we'll see if I'm able to, is, as usual, start with a little recap with a bit of additional detail. Because I was rushing a little bit at the end last time, I may take a little extra time on this, so I don't know if we'll get through the rest of it completely, but we have another lecture on Tuesday, so everything should fit between this lecture and the next one. Once we've talked a little bit more about this whole sort of linearization scheme and so on, then I want to talk about how you handle pairs of systems. So I want to talk about joint probability weights. Let's just say joint probability. And together with that, in connection with that, I want to talk about the no signaling principle. And as you'll see, once you have that, the concept of entanglement almost hits you in the face. So all of that will be one topic. Hopefully we can fit that in. I don't know if I will get any further than that, but the topic that follows that, which we may or may not get to then, is given this discussion, how should one frame a general definition of a composite system, or putting it differently, if you have two probabilistic models, how do you put them together to represent two systems sort of viewed side by side? Okay, so so last time, we saw that if you have any probabilistic model, say A, which of course, you know, has its test space, M of A, and its designated state space, designated set of probability weights, omega of A, which we are at this point always assuming is a closed convex set. We're also assuming that test spaces from now until I say otherwise, if I do, are locally finite. All tests are finite. That is going to imply that this is actually compact if it's closed. Given those fairly weak assumptions, at least weak if we're interested in finite dimensional things, we were able to construct from the model A an ordered vector space V of A. And of course, once we have that, we also have its dual space, which I'm going to start calling V star of A. That's just my sort of shorthand for V of A star. And I just find it somehow easier to write if I put the star next to the V. Okay? So what do these look like? Well, a little bit informally, V of A is the space spanned by a convex cone that has its lower vertex at the origin and is sliced through by a hyperplane that cuts through the cone precisely in the state space. All right? So everything in the positive cone is a multiple, and uniquely a multiple, of something in the state space, everything except zero. So if I have a state here, there's a unique normalized state, a unique proper state of which this is a multiple, and there's only one such state and only one factor by which it's a multiple. So I can normalize non-zero states, non-zero positive elements of this space. V star is where the effects live. So V star, in fact, is isomorphic to the set of bounded affine functionals on the state space. In the literature, you'll find that space often denoted this way, right? So affine functionals, convex combination preserving real valued functions from, you know, on the state space and bounded. Among these, you have a unit functional U which is the unique extension to a linear functional on all of big V of the affine functional on the state space that just takes every normalized state to 1. Once you have that, actually let me move sideways. Once you have that unit functional, you can define effects which are a sort of generalized measurement outcomes, if you like. They are linear functionals, positive linear functionals in V star that are less than or equal to this unit functional. Positive, they're greater than or equal to 0 on all states. Yes?
So there you said that V star is isomorphic to the affine functional.
Yes.
Omega, but before you had defined it as linear functional.
Yes, so what I mean by this, let me clarify. It's isomorphic, not identical. Mm-hmm. Things in here are linear functionals defined therefore on the entire space V. Things in here are functions defined only on this small set. The isomorphism goes this way. Clearly, if I have a linear functional on all of V, I can restrict it to just this little patch omega. And because it's fully linear, it's certainly going to preserve convex linear combinations, so it's affine. And it's bounded because this means bounded linear functionals. The interesting part is going the other direction. If you have a bounded affine functional on omega, you can show, it's not totally trivial, but you can show using a sort of Hahn-Banach-like argument, that a separation argument, that it extends uniquely to a linear functional on this thing. Okay, so that may be the main takeaway, is that any affine functional on this set determines uniquely a linear functional, extends uniquely to a linear functional on the whole space.
Is there an easily described relationship between these two things?
Besides the one, well, between these two things or these two things?
No, those two things, the equivalence.
Yeah, the equivalence is just what I mentioned. There's a mapping from here to here by restriction. It's a linear mapping. And this is also a vector space because I can add and scalar multiply. And then the tricky part is showing that it's a surjection, that it's onto, that everything here.
This is just a
concept.
There's no intrinsic sort of obvious reason why.
No, it's not an obvious thing. It's just it turns out to be a very convenient, very useful mathematical fact that any bounded affine functional on this compact convex set will extend linearly to the whole space. Right, in a unique way. Okay? And so that I guess addresses that. All right, so these are the effects. We are interested in them because they are precisely the things that assign to states in a convex combination preserving way numbers between 0 and 1, which we think of as probabilities. So we think of, or maybe I should say, for every normalized state, alpha, and I'll just call it omega, we think of alpha of A, sorry, wrong way around, A is a function of alpha, so A of alpha, as quote unquote the probability of A in state alpha. So these carry the same interpretation that the outcomes of the underlying test space do, but they're more general. Now, we can certainly construct concrete examples of such effects from the test space. So for example, for every event, and I'm going to use the same sort of, a little confusingly perhaps, the same notation for events and effects, but if I have an event, a subset of a test, an actual set of outcomes that sits inside some test, then I can define an effect, which I'll call a hat, in this sort of interval of effects, just by setting a hat of alpha equal to the probability of the event in state alpha, which we've been writing like that, but which is ultimately defined to be the sum of the probabilities of the outcomes
belonging to that event. So every event gives you an effect just by evaluation, just in that way.
Mm-hmm. So, but these definitions, they don't give you an isomorphism between the space of effects and the test space.
Correct. Okay. So what we've got here is a mapping. From the outcome space of our test space into that interval, taking an outcome thought of as a one element event to the corresponding evaluation functional, which is an effect. And these have the property that if you add them up over a test, you will get the unit effect because the probabilities have to add up to one on any normalized state. And a little bit more generally, if I have a not just a test, but maybe a test partitioned into non-empty events, then if I add up the hats of those events, I'll still get U. So what we can, a way to look at this is that within this effect interval, if I can call it that, 0 to U, you have the potential to define lots and lots of, well, to reuse the word, potential measurements, potential discrete measurements. You can define an observable or a discrete observable. This is often done in the literature. Observable to be a family of effects, let's say non-zero effects, so I'll do that. That add up to the unit effect. And then if we think of these as sort of potential measurement outcomes, this is saying that the probabilities of those measurement outcomes will add up to one in any state. So it's sort of a potential model of a measurement. So from this point of view, we start to say, oh, well, maybe what the test space is doing is just singling out some particular set of observables for whatever reason. Maybe they're, you know, particularly easy to implement. Maybe there are things we build everything else out of. Maybe we're just interested in them for some reason. So there's a kind of representation of the test space inside this big space of observables. Conversely, this big space of observables is a test space. It is a test space. And if you ask, what are all of the probability weights on that test space? Well, since we're restricting ourselves now to finite tests and I guess observables, you have to impose a continuity requirement. Basically, you ask what are all of the probability weights on this big test space of all the observables that are, let's say, you know, continuous in some weak way. It turns out to be exactly the states you started with. So you've got this big test space that has a naturally associated state space with this continuity requirement that is the one you started with. So at this point, you can sort of begin to ask yourself, well, look, if I had just known what omega was, if I'd just known omega and you hadn't told me what the test space was, or even what the outcome set was, you'd just given me omega as an abstract convex compact set. Well, then I could still have built this cone and this vector space. I could still have built the dual. I could still have identified the unit functional. I could still have defined effects, and I could have defined observables and use that as my test space, so why the rest of it? And the answer to that is twofold. This is where I was sort of finishing off last time and perhaps going too fast. So let's actually ask the question sort of formally here. Why not just use omega, an abstract compact convex set, the order interval and the set of observables on that sort of as my model. So there are two answers. Answer one, it's hard to find a physical justification for arbitrary, by physical I sort of also mean operational, justification for arbitrary effects or for arbitrary observables. My R's and my V's look about the same or less. So let me dilate on that just a little bit. We can certainly form effects that are not just evaluation functionals of events from events by averaging. So suppose that I have a couple of events, A1, A2, well, maybe through AN. So those are all events, not necessarily coming from the same test. You can just pick them, you know, any way you want. You can make a case that if you have non-negative coefficients, T1 through TN, summing to 1, in other words, if you have a little probability distribution on the index set, or alternatively, if you have convex coefficients, then that, or with hat there, these are the evaluation functionals going with these events, this effect, and it is an effect, as you can easily check, makes some sense. You say, well, I'm rolling an n-sided die that's weighted in some way so that these are the probabilities, and if I get, if the die comes up with I spots or something like that, whatever it is, then I will measure a sub I. Simple as that. So that's pretty operational. The problem is that in general, not every effect can be built that way. There are effects that are not convex combinations of the event effects. So if you buy that every effect should be allowed as a legitimate measurement outcome, that's called the no restriction, people just write NR, the no restriction hypothesis for effects, even if you allow all the effects. Then the question is, how do you build, or maybe if you're in a situation where for some happy reason, all the effects are actually convex combinations of event effects, if we can call them that. Fine. Then how do you justify arbitrary observables in this very general sense? How do I actually construct a measurement that has these, as my outcomes? You can, to some extent, play a similar averaging game or randomization game with tests, but to do that in a way that works out nicely, you have to do something like this. You have to say, maybe I've got test E1, maybe I've got test E2, and then, yes, I could flip a coin or, a weighted coin to decide which one to perform, and then, write down an answer. It works better if you have some sort of a matching, like a bijection between them, so that you can say, if I performed E1, I'll write down, not only what I got, but also the thing I would have gotten over here, and that gives you a sort of averaged event to be, averaged effect to be the outcome. Anyway, it gets a little trickier, and it's still not the case that all the observables in general will show up that way. So bottom line, the first answer to the question is we don't know a general reason why or a general recipe that will justify treating all the effects and all the observables as physical, right? We're assuming that the things that come from events and tests in M are physically accessible. That's sort of what it means to say they're part of the model. But given that, how do you how do you flesh out the rest of the event, the effect interval? Nobody knows, and it doesn't look easy to do. So that's one answer. And that's why this no restriction hypothesis, either for events or for observables, is held in some suspicion within the community. It's not taken as an innocent assumption. You sometimes make it for convenience. All right, there's another answer. And the other answer has to do with sequential measurements. And so let me see if I can be a little clearer than I was last time. So answer two, sequential measurements don't linearize in the first argument. So remember, if I have, let's just talk about a single model. I want to take the model and I want to admit two-stage tests. Outcomes are ordered pairs. First outcome, second outcome. All of the probability weights on this, all of the states, look like alpha semicolon beta, where alpha is just an ordinary probability weight. It assigns probability alpha of x to x. But beta is a function from outcomes, say x, to probability weights. And it assigns to the pair xy beta sub x of y, like that. One can write down examples to show this, but suppose we wanted to somehow linearize all of this, okay? Suppose we want to in particular, suppose we want to find linear representation of this. Just look at the form of this over here. If this expression is somehow supposed to be extended to something that is linear in its arguments, it's not going to work. Right? At best, it would be quadratic in x. Yes? So this can be extended to something that is linear in y, but it will never be linear in x, right? Unless beta is a constant function that doesn't depend on x. So that means that while we can certainly form big V of A forward arrow A, it is not a function of, I'm going to write this very schematically, it's not something that looks like, some big function of V of A and, V of A, right? It doesn't depend linearly on that first factor. It's a more complicated construction that actually requires you to know what the outcome set X is and how weights depend on, at the second stage depend on that. So because of that, it seems to me a little bit hasty to say we're just going to get rid of the test spaces and just use this linear framework. In particular, what this means, incidentally, is that you could have two outcomes or maybe two events that are equiprobable in the model A. They have the same probability in every state. Those turn into the same effect when we put hats on them. But if we are, so to speak, conditioning on them in a formula like this, those different outcomes that are equiprobable may be determining different secondary, sort of conditional states, in which case, you know, you would in the two-stage experiment, you'd actually see that they're different. Even if you performed only one measurement, they would look the same probabilistically. Is that making sense to people? Okay. All right. So, you know, I can put more detail about this in the notes. So if people are still wanting to see more detail, please let me know and I can maybe write out an example or something like that that would help. But I would like to talk a little bit about joint probability weights because this is where things get even more interesting. All right? So let's talk about joint probability weights. So let's just start with something really simple. If I have two discrete, indeed finite, classical experiments, you know, like rolling two dice, we all know what a joint probability weight would be, right? Yes? It's just a function of two arguments that gives you non-negative numbers and adds up to one over both arguments. It's a probability weight on a Cartesian product of sets. That's all. All right, so that suggests the following construction. Right now, I'm going to, just for the moment, move away from models back to just plain test spaces. Suppose I have two test spaces. Script A and script B, right? That's a collection of possible experiments associated maybe with some agent, Alice, and this maybe is Bob's test space, okay? If we want to talk about joint probability weights, we better be able to talk about joint measurements or joint experiments, right? For those weights to attach probabilities to. So there's a natural construction. Using, or rather abusing, notation in a, what turns out to be a useful way, we're going to write A cross B, not literally for the Cartesian product of these two sets, but rather for the set of Cartesian products of the outcome spaces that they contain. All right, is that okay with everybody? It's just the test space consisting of all the joint measurements Alice and Bob can make. Alice makes measurement E, Bob makes measurement F. And they, you know, they collate their results, and so the outcomes are just ordered pairs. Yes? So far, so good? Ian?
Are they allowed to have probability zero of occurring? Some things may not be possible.
Yes, it's. I mean, you might have some probability weights that assign probability zero to certain pairs. Can happen. Okay. So what do I mean by a joint probability weight on script A and script B? Of course, I just mean an element of the set of probability weights on this collection of joint measurements. That's all. So it's just an assignment of probabilities to arbitrary Cartesian products of tests, one from script A, one from script B. Yeah, that's all. Okay, seems simple enough. What is the single most sort of basic operation that you perform on a joint probability weight, sort of classically? What's
the product of two?
Well, yeah, you could form the product of two probability weights. That's a basic way of making such a thing. We'll come back to that. But suppose I hand you one. I say, here's a joint probability weight, big table.
Marginals?
Marginals, yes. You take marginals. So we can do that. So how about marginals? Sure, we can do that. Of course. What do I want to do? I want to take my joint probability weight, and I want to assign a sort of first marginal. Let me call it omega sub 1. And so that would assign a probability to x that would presumably be obtained by summing over all the outcomes sort of y on Bob's side. Like that. And can anybody immediately see what the issue is going to be? I mean, that is the classical formula, right?
It depends on F.
It depends on F, right? We've got more than one F. Alice, in general, has, you know, or rather Bob, has many measurements he could make. So actually, because this depends on F, we'd better indicate that over here somewhere. So I'm just going to put an F here, just because there's room for it. All right? Yeah, we can define marginals. We can do it in the other way, you know, second marginal, depending on a particular choice of measurement that Alice might make, would be obtained by summing over Alice's outcomes, like that. Okay, so let me just note, you know, these are legitimate probability weights. This is a probability weight, this sort of first marginal for a given fixed measurement F on Bob's side. This is a probability weight on Alice's test space. This is a probability weight on Bob's test space. I'm going to say that a joint probability weight on A cross B, or for A and B, is a joint state of two models. If these marginals all turn out to belong to whatever the designated state space might be. Right, that seems like the reasonable thing to do. But let's return to the fact that these marginals depend on which measurement you make. And they really can. You just write down simple examples. They obviously depend a lot on E and F. So you could ask, what's wrong with that? You know, big deal. It's not quite classical. We pay a price. Well, maybe nothing is wrong with it in general, but there is something wrong with it in one context. Can I raise this? Is it all right to put this up here? Actually, I guess, you know, it seems to me these slidey boards are wonderful. I like them. But they also represent a little bit of a hazard for somebody who's fundamentally indecisive like I am. Yes, I can spend a lot of time trying to figure out which way I want to sort of arrange them. Okay, here's the problem. If Alice and Bob, A and B, let's call them, are far apart, you know, in space, then this is a problem. Because if for instance, say Bob's, if Bob's marginal probability really depends on which measurement Alice makes, then Alice can actually send signals to Bob, modulated by her choice of measurement. And that seems in tension with relativity. So if A and B are far apart, let me say it this way. These shouldn't depend on E and F. And that motivates another definition. Definition, little omega in probability weights on A cross B is non-signaling. I'll just write NS for short. If and only if omega 1 F equals omega 1 F prime for all F and F prime in script B, the first marginal doesn't depend on what measurement Bob chooses to do, and similarly, omega 2 marginal with respect to E equals omega 2 omega 2 with respect to E prime for all tests E and E prime in Alice's test space. Doesn't matter what Alice does, that doesn't affect the probabilities that Bob will see. Okay? So, easy exercise, the set of non-signaling probability weights, which I'll just write like that, is convex. Averages of non-signaling probability weights are non-signaling. And so we can actually make a model at this point, right? We can make a model like this. Let me return to the case where A is Alice's model with some state space. I guess I'll just write it like this. And Bob's is script B with some state space. Then I'm going to define omega and S for A and B to be, can't quite do this. I'm getting ahead of myself, my apologies. So ignore this, you didn't see it, right? Erase the evidence, please, right? Okay, what I wanna say is that, you know, we could use that as our state space and make a simple model where our test space is script A cross script B, but this is our designated state space. That's already a probabilistic model and it's an interesting one. Let me show you what you can do once you have a non-signaling state. You can do some pretty cool stuff all at once. So let's suppose that omega is non-signaling. One of the things that I can do conveniently is I can define conditional states unambiguously. Sort of bipartite conditional states. I can define a probability, for example, for Bob, the second component, given an outcome on Alice's side to be the probability of seeing X and Y divided by the probability of Alice seeing X, and that's now sort of unambiguously defined. It's just Alice's marginal, which doesn't depend on anything on Bob's side. Okay, this is of course assuming that that denominator is not zero, right? Just as usual. All right, so I have a well-defined conditional state. And similarly on Bob's side, I can condition on, Bob's side I can condition on Alice having gotten, other way around. On Alice's side I can condition on Bob having gotten outcome. Why? All right, so with those definitions, we can write down something else that's really cool. As usual with conditional probabilities, there's another way of writing them just by multiplying through by the denominators. So I could write down, for instance, I could write down omega 1 of x times the conditional probability omega 2x, 2 given x. And if I evaluate that at, say, at y, I'll get omega of xy. But now notice if I sum over the x's, I'm going to get the second marginal, omega 2. So from this, we see that the second marginal omega 2 can be decomposed as the sum, as little x goes over e, of omega 1 of x times omega 2 given x. And then, you know, stick the y's in. That is extremely useful, simple, but so useful. This is a bipartite and sort of generalized version of a very familiar fact from elementary probability theory, namely what's sometimes called the law of total probability. Okay? So let's call it that. This is the law of total probability, or the bipartite version of it. And every time I abbreviate it, I think of a certain book, but you know, what can I do? All right, well, that's really cool. So one of the things that makes it really cool is, and I'm going to come back to this in just a second, but let me sort of set the stage and get you thinking, is that this gives me omega 2 as a convex combination of these conditional probabilities, right? These numbers add up to 1. Non-negative and add up to 1. So this is a convex combination of these conditional states. Moreover, I can decompose omega 2 according to this formula in many different ways, because this is independent of which E I choose, right? Or rather, I shouldn't say independent, the right hand. The sum is independent. The formula holds for every E. Okay, so hold that thought in mind. Think about what it might imply. But first, let's introduce the following idea. One easy way to make a joint probability weight, just as, remind me, your name is, who are you again?
Me?
Yes.
Sathiris.
Sathiris. Just as Sathiris was saying, one way to make a joint probability weight is just to multiply two probability weights. So definition, if alpha's a probability weight on A and beta's a probability weight on B, maybe they're in the state spaces that we care about, maybe not, then alpha tensor beta, like written like that, is going to be the function whose value at pair xy is alpha of x times beta of y. And it's pretty clear that that's a joint probability weight, yes? For just the usual reasons. So that's in the non-signaling set. Well, the non-signaling set is convex. That means I get to form convex combinations of things like this. So therefore, any weighted average of these, let's call them product probability weights, is again a non-signaling probability weight. And that makes some sense. These are probability weights in which you just have a classical mixture of sort of states of affairs in which Alice and Bob are independent of one another. So any correlations you might see between Alice and Bob are sort of explained by this classical mixing that's going on. Well, great.
If there was signaling, could you write this as like alpha x, b x, y, just like in the sequential measurements?
If there were signaling, yes. But I'll come back to that. So I'll make a connection with the forward and back, the forward product in a minute. So good question. But meanwhile, I just want to ask you guys, what shall we call states of this particular form? Anyone want to propose a name?
Product states?
Say again?
Product states.
Well, these are the product states. But I mean for all the mixtures of the product states.
Yeah,
separable, let's call them, I don't know why, let's just call them separable. Sure, those are separable. Now, you can write down simple examples. If you know quantum mechanics, you can write down examples there too, but you don't have to do that. You can write down very simple examples to convince yourself that not every non-signaling joint probability weight is going to be separable. In fact, very rarely will that be the case. Very, very rarely. Okay, I want to leave this here, so I'm going to go over here. It is a fact, which I'll talk about, I guess, in more detail next time, that unless probability weights on A or probability weights on B are, or unless one of those at least is a simplex very simplest kind of convex set, the non-signaling states will always properly contain the separable ones. There will always be non-separable, non-signaling joint states. Once again, we should have a name for those. What shall we call them? We should, yeah, exactly. So omega is entangled if and only if omega is non-signaling but not separable. It turns out that entangled states at this level of generality still enjoy lots of the famous properties enjoyed by entangled states in quantum mechanics. And in fact, often the proofs are just exactly the same, but without invoking any Hilbert space. You just need some tests on each side and the non-signaling condition. So let me illustrate that by putting the law of conditional probability to use and proving this little little lemma. Suppose omega is non-signaling. If its second marginal is pure, in other words, an extreme state, extreme probability weight, then omega is equal to a product state. Specifically, it's the product of its marginals. Here's the proof. Actually, before I write the proof down, is everybody comfortable with what that's saying? Notice I'm not mentioning entanglement yet. This is just a general statement about non-signaling states. Yes, a non-signaling state with a pure marginal, in this case the second marginal, will work on the other side too, must be a product state. Here's how you prove that. Look at the law of total probability. This tells me that omega 2 is this convex combination of the conditional states, omega 2 given x, as x ranges over any test that I like. That's a convex decomposition. When you represent a pure state, an extreme state or an extreme point of a convex set, as a convex combination, that means the convex combination actually had to be trivial. And trivial means that every time a coefficient is not zero, the term with that coefficient is actually equal to the state you're representing. So this implies, the purity of omega implies, that for all x with omega 1 of x not zero, omega 2 given x is equal to omega 2. All right? Okay, so that means that omega 2 given x, which is a function of y that looks like omega xy over omega 1 of x is equal to omega sub 2 of y. That holds. And now just multiply through by the denominator. That implies that omega of xy is equal to omega 1 of x times omega 2 of y. And that has to hold for all y's. And there's a teeny little minor detail. So far, we know it holds for every x in E, where E is the test we summed over. Oh, but E is arbitrary. It doesn't matter which test we summed over. So this is for every X in any test in script A, and you put those together, and it's true for every little X. And so there you go. Omega is a product state, just the one I claimed. All right, so you're familiar, I think, with this fact in quantum mechanics, right? A joint density matrix that has a pure marginal is actually a product. See? And just as in that context, you have the same corollary here, which is the monogamy of entanglement. So, corollary. If omega is entangled, so non-signaling by definition and not separable, then its marginals are mixed. I'm sorry, that's not the monogamy of entanglement. That comes later. So you get the fact that entangled states have mixed marginals. You can go on and prove a bunch of other things. You can prove a version of the monogamy of entanglement. You can prove, actually, one of the things that I will try to show you next time is that you can actually get a version of teleportation to work in close to this generality. You can do all sorts of cool things with no quantum mechanics in sight. The basic takeaway is that properties of the existence of entangled states and properties of entanglement, the basic properties of entanglement anyway, are not in any way inherently or specifically quantum mechanical. They are actually pretty generically non-classical. Yes? And that's all. So I'll close with I'm actually early today for some reason. I'm going to close with a bit of historical remark making. Pretty much everything I've shown you today was worked out by Foulis and Randall in a paper, actually two papers, but one in particular in 1981. They didn't really talk about entanglement, but they did talk about the general setup and the law of total probabilities in that paper and so on. The connection with the literature on entangled states in quantum mechanics had to wait a few years, but in the mid-80s, there was this really cool postdoc, Matthias Klei, who came to visit Amherst, and he wrote a paper with them, Klei, Foulis and Randall, in 1985 or six, let's just say six. And then he wrote on his own a wonderful follow-up paper published in 1988, and that's the one I specifically want to mention. In that paper, Klei actually points out, and as far as I know, this is the first time anybody pointed it out anywhere in the literature, that you could do pretty much all the things that people were accustomed to doing in connection with entangled states in this kind of very super general context. He talks about these basic properties of entanglement. He actually defines entanglement. He actually looks at what Bell's theorem looks like in this context. So it was a paper, I think, very much ahead of its time. This is actually just slightly before the dawn of quantum information theory. Because it was just slightly before the dawn of quantum information theory, nobody cared. So, that's what happens when you're ahead of your time, right? So I mentioned that. I want to ask a quick question. Some of these papers are a little difficult to track down because they also predate the internet and the archive and so on. And they're often behind very annoying paywalls. If you have the necessary skills, that won't bother you at all. But if you don't, or if you have certain scruples, it might. But I do have access to some of them, Would people like me to start putting some things up on the Dropbox, some of these scans of some of these older papers? I'll see what I can do. Also, I want to mention that under prodding by Ian, I've assembled a short glossary of notations and terms, which is also now on Dropbox, in the Dropbox. And that one, I really want to invite people to make suggestions to me for additions. But actually, I think when I set the Dropbox up, I didn't really pay much attention to the settings. And I think many of you, or most of you, actually technically have the right to edit things. So you can go on and just, you know, edit the PDF and just say, you know, add this. And I can go change that. Maybe I'll even put the LaTeX source code up there, and then you can just, you know, add to it. That would save me a little work and maybe make it a little more targeted. All right, we actually have a tiny bit of time here, so I don't know how that happened, but let's use it. Questions, yes. First you and then Ian, so go ahead.
Is there any condition we can impose on the model of an individual system so that any probabilities of a composite system is non-signally?
That's a great question. I do not know of any except one that's far too drastic, which is it's classical, it's got a simplex state space, and then everything will automatically be separable, not just non-signally. Actually, I want to back off of that. I take that back. I have to be even more exacting. If Alice and Bob only have, well, let's say Alice, if Alice only has one measurement she can make, she can't signal. Right, and so that's the condition. So as long as there are two measurements that each party can make, then in principle they can each signal in each direction. And the only way to prevent that is, that I know of, is to say something about the joint model. Now, actually maybe I can say just a tiny bit about more about this that also will address Marina's question from a moment ago. Which is that there are now lots and lots of ways that we could make sort of non-signaling models, models of non-signaling composites. Let me just describe two. One is we could take a model A and a model B, and we could define something, maybe we'd call it just like the non-signaling Cartesian product or something like that, where what we would do is we would take A's test space, B's test space, form this, you know, sort of very silly minimal composite of those test spaces where we're just looking at joint measurements, and then look at the what I'll call the non-signaling state space, where by this I mean the set of all non-signaling probability weights such that all the conditional weights are in the right state spaces. Right, that seems like the reasonable way to cut down the state space if Alice and Bob have preferred states. And that will guarantee that the marginals are in the right places as well. So you could do that, but here I really had to reach in and choose the non-signaling condition, just impose that. Yes? Another thing you could do is you could form what is called, and this is in the Fowlis and Randall paper that I mentioned, the very first one, the bilateral composite or tensor product. They wrote a tensor product symbol, but well, anyway, I won't do that. I'll put a double arrow thing here, which is constructed this way. You take Alice's test space and Bob's test space, and you allow Alice and Bob to perform sequential measurements in that direction. And you also allow Bob to go first. So you rig up an appropriate test space going in that direction. Same construction, it's just that you union over a fixed test on Bob's side, and then there are different choices of tests on Alice's side. And then what you do is you say, okay, I'm going to look at all of the probability weights here, just on this, that have the right conditional states. Notice I don't need to write a little ns down here. The reason is all probability weights on this test space are automatically non-signaling. So in particular, if we're in a situation where Alice and Bob have full models, they don't have specialized state spaces, they're just willing to admit all probability weights, then this would also be a full model. I just construct this state space, test space, and non-signaling would be automatic, and there's no special restriction on what the conditional probabilities have to look like, so I don't even have to write that down. So this would be a full model. Marina, does that address your question to some extent? Right. Now, what's kind of cool about this is that it says that if you have classical signaling, signaling where Alice can actually sort of, you know, get on the telephone and tell Bob, I got outcome X, you should do, you know, test F sub X. That prevents Bob from sending signals back to Alice, modulated by the choice of measurement. Throwing this in means that Bob still has a telephone, he can still call Alice, but now Alice cannot send signals to Bob, modulated by her choice of test. So classical signaling in one direction prohibits spooky signaling in the other direction. And if we insist on classical communication in both directions, we have no signaling in either direction. That's kind of a useful observation. Now, neither of these is really a very satisfactory notion, a very satisfactory general notion of a composite system. So next time, I'm going to talk more about how we should define composites in general and talk some more about their structure and how you linearize them, what happens when you try to linearize these constructions. OK, any other last minute questions? Oh, Ian, you had a question. Yeah, sorry.
I was wondering where in all this discussion about generalized probabilities, we actually left classical probabilities behind.
It's a wonderful question, and I've thought about that myself a lot over the years. This really does seem like an extremely minimal, very, very conservative extension of classical probability theory. And it's very difficult to avoid at least sometimes having the feeling that, you know, with just a little sort of crick of the neck, change of perspective a little bit, maybe one could find some way of just embedding the whole story in classical probability theory. I actually wrote a paper about this that no one has read. Probably because it's not on the archive. I put it in the Phil Tsai archive, the one for philosophy of science, but I didn't put it in the real archive. But anyway, and it's a book chapter, and nobody's going to buy a book to read it. But the point I tried to make there is that you can make a good case for the concept of non-classicality being pretty much conventional. That there are in fact various ways in which you can take any, let us say, general or generalized probabilistic theory and represent it in purely classical terms. It's not a unique such way, but there are several such ways. All of them run afoul of locality issues in that when you ask the questions that Bell did ask, what would it mean for a sort of a classical representation to be local, you find that when you have entangled states around, the local, rather the hidden variables models can't be, or the classical representations cannot be local in the appropriate senses. But what that says to me is, and this is sort of the argument I'm making, that The probabilistic infrastructure could still be regarded as classical. You're just imposing sort of a physical restriction that's something like what's another example? You know, you can embed any manifold in a sufficiently high-dimensional Euclidean space, right? So you could say space-time, that's just sitting in some really big Euclidean space. You know, who needs all this fancy differential geometry? And the reason we don't do that is that we don't think those extra sort of degrees of freedom are real, right? But that's a physical choice. It's not dictated by the mathematics. And so I guess what I would say is the probability theory here is only barely non-classical, if that. But it's viewed from a sufficiently, in a sufficiently loose way, maybe, that you can, you know, when you present it in this way, you begin to see possibilities that you missed if you just started with, you know, a measurable space and a sigma algebra of sets and so on. And some of those possibilities turn out to be physically real. And some of the possibilities that you could entertain for explaining those interesting possibilities in a sort of traditional classical way don't look very physically real or meaningful. But anyway, all of that's a long way of saying, please go read my paper. All right, well, thanks very much, everybody. And so with luck, we'll meet on Tuesday, and I will finish the story of composite systems and so on. And then we can think about what we're going to do in April.